Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Oh, you're very welcome back. 0870 32 32 32 is the WhatsApp. Sean Hewitt is an acclaimed poet whose first novel has created a level of excitement among book fans, book people, as the Marvel hero might for the superhero followers. Open Heaven will spark memories you've had of your first crush, especially if it's an excruciating one where your affections maybe weren't returned. But it is a gorgeous novel. It's set in 2002, but it feels like it could even be a period piece that isn't afraid of flourish and beauty and lovely language. What else would you expect from a young romantic poet who joins us now? Sean Hewitt, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I spoke to you briefly before on the phone once, so we know we have you have a lovely English accent with some Irish vowels and an extremely Irish name, replete with fada and everything.
Yeah.
So you've got the proper dual British and Irish.
I've got the half and half. My mum is from Limerick and my dad was English. So I was raised in Warrington, which is in the north of England, but I've lived in Dublin for 8 years now. So my accent is probably morphing somewhere along the way, yeah.
And how many of you were in the family?
There was three brothers.
Yeah. All boys?
All boys.
And Mammy from Limerick?
Mammy's from Limerick,
yeah. Is she a livery head on her?
No, she was a primary school teacher and then she worked in a university in teacher training.
Oh.
So and dad was a joiner.
He was a joiner, as in working in the joining factory all the
woodwork. Yeah, he was like woodwork, renovating houses, that sort of stuff. Oh, yeah, very practical.
The difference between a carpenter and a joiner.
I believe a joiner fits the things carpenters make into houses. So it's more like, like stud walls and kitchens and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. I knew a writer would finally correct that. And you also work in universities now yourself?
Yeah, I work in Trinity in Dublin. Yeah, I teach people how to write, I hope.
And it's a master's course, isn't it?
It's a master's course,
so does that mean that you're teaching people who might be older than you?
Sometimes, yeah.
That's all normal, so it's okay. Especially when you're a writer, teaching people how to write, that must be a wild romantic class.
Yeah,
with ideas and so on.
I mean, it's, you know, sometimes for the students, it's quite an exposing thing, you know, to share a work in progress. And so you have to be mindful of that. But really, I'm trying to help people to find a way to write that best suits what they want to write about in their own voice. So it's not really fitting them into a mold. It's trying to encourage them on the path that I can kind of see that they're already on.
They help you as well?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, it makes a big difference to be able to spend all day talking about writing, because then inevitably you kind of scurry back to your office and you have new ideas, or you think, I've just told everyone to do this and I'm not doing it myself, so I should probably do that. Yeah.
Assistant professor, does that mean we can't call you Professor Sean Hewitt?
No, not yet. Doctor.
Oh, you're a doctor, that's absolutely fine. Having an Irish mum in England, is that something that you were made aware of along the way? By other people, I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it was not uncommon in the north of England. You know, there's so many Irish people around, but you know, I was raised Catholic, but I always went to a Church of England school. So I always felt kind of different in that respect.
Right.
I went to Catholic church on a Sunday and then Anglican church on a Wednesday.
Oh, you
so I was kind of doing a little reformation every week. You know? I was going back and to between them.
A Wednesday for Protestantism, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, you had to go to the... That's bizarre.
Yeah, we did hymn practice on a Wednesday.
Just don't tell the parish priest.
No.
Accepting communion would be excommunicado entirely. And your dad was from a small... He was one of two siblings.
Yeah, one of two siblings. And his mum was on her own. Her dad, husband died in the 50s. So my dad's dad died when he was quite young. So there was a very small family.
Compared to the huge family on the Irish side.
Yeah, mum was one of nine. So that's a big family.
Right.
And a lot of cousins. In fact, I actually met a cousin a couple of weeks ago that I didn't know existed. So
probably got to keep happening. Yeah. What are the surnames on the Irish side?
O'Callaghan's my mum's maiden name. O'Callaghan's and Downey's mostly.
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah. Hewitt, it's kind of like a semi-Irish name, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of Hewitts in the north.
Yeah.
But I haven't met any in Dublin. Yeah.
not yet. Yeah. Well, as soon as you announce it. And sadly, you lost your father a couple of years ago.
Yeah. I lost him just as I was on the way to publishing my first collection of poetry.
Ah, the cruelty,
yeah. But it was, you know, in some ways it was good because he knew that the book was coming out. You know, I'd already signed the contract on it and we had kind of the manuscripts. So he'd read it. And then I made changes to the manuscripts after the fact.
Of course.
Yeah, with new poems about him. So
was he a fan of your writing?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's always nice to have, you know, I come from a family that's not writers and they're not bookish. You know, often writers come from families with libraries and, you know, parents that write and that sort of stuff. But, you know, in some ways it's been a journey for all of us because they have kind of been indoctrinated into the world of poetry and literature and
really?
And got to see how that happens.
With fresh eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And in some ways, you know, it's good to have readers that are in some way fresh to writing and know what they enjoy because their focus is often on enjoyment. And I think often writers, you know, if you're aiming towards other writers and very literary types, mm-hmm. you can kind of miss what people enjoy about reading.
So you learned that from your family?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Very good. It was a sudden illness.
Yeah, he was diagnosed with lung cancer, which is a shock because he's like never smoked. And he started off with really severe pains in his head. So that was the metastatic brain tumour. But by the time they caught that, the lung cancer was really advanced. So, yeah.
It was short and it was very...
It was very short, yeah. I think I was over in Manchester just around St. Patrick's Day launching a little pamphlet of poems. And then he had died by June. They told me in March he died by June, yeah.
Does being a poet help in any way? Because you were barely 30, were you even 30?
No. I was 29. Does being a poet help? I mean, in some ways, you know, you get the chance to put into words and memorialize things. And in some ways, I think poems are often, you know, even if they might be about other things, they're about holding a moment in time and setting it down. And so in that way, I can kind of read those early poems of my own and remember things about my dad or remember things about what I was thinking or feeling mm-hmm. at that time that I might otherwise have forgotten because it's quite a disorientating time, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Confusing.
Yeah. And really warm. Confusing. Yeah.
So when you get these milestones like your debut novel, which you're, I know you've launched already in America.
Yeah.
These will be the kind of sad moments as well, bittersweet.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually, I think I was very jet lagged on Sunday and I went to bed at like 9 p.m. and my boyfriend came into the bedroom at about 10 o'clock and apparently I woke up and said, my dad is making salmon and chips. So it was obviously on my mind. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You were kind of sleep talk.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why salmon and chips. That doesn't sound like a great meal, but yeah.
What's that his go-to?
I don't know. He wasn't a great cook.
Okay. Well, we will not hold that against him. What about the brothers? Are they into books as well?
No, my older brother is a builder. And my younger brother works for Adidas. He's really into sport. So I'm very much the odd one out.
Family, yeah. It's good. Sometimes it's a disappointment when you hear that. Yeah. I come from a literary family.
I mean,
anyway.
I've no competition. You know, none of us are competing with each other, so it's fine.
It's like, phew, there won't be other Hewitts launching novels. Yes, you say that now. Tell us about Open Heaven and why, what it's about, first of all.
Yeah, so it is a book. It's set over four seasons. As you said, it's mostly set in 2002. You go from the autumn through to the summer, and it's about a young boy called James, and he falls in love with his friend Luke, and he can't tell if Luke loves him back or not. So he's kind of trying to decode what is all in his head, what is kind of what love is doing in terms of his imagination and what might be real. And I suppose over the course of a year, he tries to find ways to tell if Luke might love him back. And he has to kind of decide what he's willing to risk in order to find that out.
And you set it over 20 years ago. Is that because it's contemporary to your teenage years?
It's kind of contemporary. You know, I didn't want James, he's about 4 years older than me, which was in a way just a method of me trying to not make the main character me. So I knew if I kind of gave him an age difference and I set him in a different place with a different family, I couldn't use him as a mouthpiece for my own life.
Temptation will be there.
Yeah, the temptation will be there. But yeah, it begins in 2022 when he is going through a divorce, and he kind of goes back to the village where he was born, and then you slip back into 2002, and he kind of tells you the story of this year, which kind of changed his life.
It's a lovely village, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thornmere.
Thornmere, yeah.
A lovely English name.
Yeah, I made it up. It's a very kind of pastoral setting. It's a small village in the countryside. And, you know, what I wanted to do, often when you have particularly love stories that have queer characters in them, they often take place in cities. You know, cities are the places yeah. where everyone finds community, and that's where life is. And I wanted to, you know, make a case for this sort of novel happening in a rural setting. I think that's recognizable to a lot of people, especially in a country like Ireland as well, you know.
For sure, yeah. The farming, especially.
Yeah.
There's a lot of farming in this.
Yeah, Luke works on a farm. He's been sent to live there. His dad is in prison and his mum has gone to France. So he goes to live with his aunt and uncle on this farm, and he's kind of working on the farm. And James is on a milk round when he first meets Luke.
Which he's been forced to work on.
Yeah.
His parents. Yeah. It's not romanticized because they're tied up for money.
Yeah, they're tied up for money. James has a younger brother who's suffering from quite severe epilepsy. Yeah. And they have all of these worries, obviously, about looking after his younger brother. And they need James to kind of cop on and grow up a little bit. Make some money.
He's disappeared into himself, hasn't he? Because he's come out at school, which seems ill-advised in 2002.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he kind of gets outed at school. He is with his friend Sarah, and she leans in to kiss him, and he kind of explains why he can't. And then within a week, everyone in school knows, as happens at schools, you know. Secret just kind of spreads very quickly, I think, in a school.
Is that your experience?
No, I was the secret spreader in my own case. I got really drunk at a rugby club party.
Oh,
so that is that does kind of happen in the novel. I was about 16, and I must have stolen some wine from the cupboard. You know, very unlike me. And I told one friend, and then I told another friend, and by the end of the night, I may as well have been on the Oliver Callan show and told the entirety of the country. So I woke up the next morning and I thought, oh, I've got to go and tell my parents now because everyone else knows.
Oh my God.
So the secret was out.
You outed yourself.
I outed myself. Yeah. Alcohol outed me, I think.
How did that go down?
It went down all right, actually. You know, in some ways, that was 2006, and it was, in a way, enough to make you a person of note within school. There were like 2,000 people in the school, and I was the only one at that point that had come out. So at the very least, everyone knew who I was, whether it was for a good reason or not.
It was an element of fame.
Yeah.
Because he experiences that, doesn't he? He goes into school and everyone's looking at, but then once everyone stops talking about it, they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. He has this
James in the novel.
Yeah, I think James in the novel has a different experience to me because he has this secret that is then taken out of his hands. You know, someone else shares it and then suddenly everyone knows. He becomes very aware that everyone knows more about him than he knows about them. And suddenly he becomes very transparent to them, at least in that one aspect of his identity. And so he goes into a sort of secret-keeping mode, I think as a form of control. You know, he's had this secret given away, and his way of controlling that is to kind of shut down and go quiet, and no one will know anything about what he's thinking.
But you didn't have to shut down in your reality.
No, I didn't have to, no.
Why did you decide to write this novel? Is it to do with that absolute panic of falling for someone and you have no idea if they've any interest in you?
Yeah. Yeah, I had this idea of writing a novel about what love does to our imaginations. When you fall in love, I think you begin to spin stories in your head. You begin to imagine futures for yourself. You begin to kind of really focus on what another person might be saying to you, or, you know, if they just kind of touch your shoulder by accident, you wonder, was it intentional or not. And I think it sends you into this sort of frenzy and where you're kind of decoding the world around you. And I wanted to have this main character going through that place where reality and fiction kind of blur. And you as a reader, James is your narrator. So you maybe can't tell as you read the book how much of it is all in his head and how much of it is real. And your job over the course of the book is going to be to decide yourself what the truth of this
is. Well, our job is rooting for this character, but he makes bad decisions. And also, because it can go horribly wrong when James's intentions are going to be revealed. And that's what you're worried about the whole way through.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's in jeopardy in a way because he's in a bind, or I put him in a bind, where he's in love with his best friend, which is in some ways a really horrible situation to find yourself in, because if he admits it, he might lose his best friend.
Yes.
And if he doesn't say it, he'll never know. So the novel kind of hangs on that really horrible tightrope between revelation and concealment. And either way, it could go wrong.
And he's got this responsibility at home with his family.
Yeah.
His little brother is unwell. And
So as he goes into the summer holidays, his parents are working and they ask him to stay at home and look after his younger brother, which means that he can't see Luke, who he's in love with. So then he has this extra level of jeopardy, which is, do I abandon my responsibility to my younger brother in the hope that I might be loved by Luke, or do I stay at home and cut off that future altogether?
And I gather you wrote it in the season, because we go through a couple of seasons.
Yeah.
You wrote it in the season that matches the narrative.
Yeah, yeah. So I wrote it over the first draft, at least, I wrote over the course of a year. And the novel starts in autumn and then you go winter, spring, summer. So it's in four parts. And as I was writing, I wrote the autumn section in the autumn. And what I tried to do there is I live near the Phoenix Park, and I would just go for walks while I was writing or take photographs or whatever, so that I could get something of the atmosphere and kind of the particularity of the season into the book. So I hope in that way it's kind of an immersive book in which the seasons play a big role.
Absolutely. That's why I described it at the start as a duvet day for the heart, because it's just a lovely place to dwell.
That's a lovely way of putting it. I like that. Yeah.
And you're into nature, I would take it,
from
the descriptions and so on.
Yeah.
Is it from growing up in a city? Were you in a city? Or
no, I wasn't in a city. I was kind of on the outskirts of a town. So it was almost like if you looked in one direction, you had this post-industrial town. And if you turned around and walked in the other direction, you had fields and canals and that sort of stuff. But it was really, it was my granddad who was from Limerick, who used to take me on walks a lot. And he kind of knew everything about trees and plants and what you could eat and what you couldn't eat. And he taught me a lot. And I think I still have some of that kind of childlike wandering around with my granddad view of nature. You know, it still kind of retains a sort of magic to me.
There's always somebody, isn't there?
Yeah.
Going to introduce you. Was your house freezing? Because I felt cold at times.
Yeah, I actually remember, you know, we had these single glazed windows in my bedroom and the water used to run down them in the mornings, and you could kind of draw on them, and they had a wooden frame, and you could
and
kind
freeze
of, and you could feel like the softness of the wood, you know, as the water was just running into them. So that is one thing I remember from being young. Yeah,
did you fall for a best friend?
Yeah, I did. I say this is not an autobiographical novel, and and yet there's so much in it that is true to me. But I mean, what I will say is, having spoken to so many of my current friends now, you know, so many of them fell in love with either someone who they couldn't admit it to, or it was someone completely unattainable to them. And I was just really interested in, like, what does it mean if so many of us, our first love is not a reciprocated love? It's in many ways a sort of self-sufficient, self-contained love that is our entire just imaginary world that we enter and have to navigate on our own. And so, I did take lessons from the torture of being in love with one of my friends. But it seems to me that, you know, it's such a common experience. And, you know, falling in love for the first time is obviously a really common experience as
this
well.
This is a teenage crush, so it's yeah. infatuation.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when you fall in love for the first time as a teenager, it's like this big operatic thing because you have no context for it. You've never done it before. And suddenly everything is massive in a way that maybe doesn't happen again. You know, as we grow up, we're a bit more guarded, or we have context for things. We have friends to speak to. We have kind of knowledge of how people behave in love and how we behave in love, and we maybe modulate our behavior a little bit. But I think as teenagers, you don't really do that. You just suddenly explode with hormones and emotions.
So what did you do? Did you tell him?
I think I told him in 1,000 what I thought were secretive ways. but I don't think that
he didn't pick any of them up.
I think he did. But the thing is, he was such a nice guy that he carried on being my friend, which
he was entirely straight.
And remains so. He's still my friend. But, you know, in many ways, him being so nice meant that it was even more of a torture because he still stayed close to me and he was still my friend.
It would be hard if you hated him.
Yeah, it would have been easy if he said, you know, go away, I'm not talking to you. And then I would have got over it, you know, maybe.
Right. Do you look back embarrassed now at that infatuation?
I think everyone feels in some way embarrassed about things they did as a teenager. But yeah. I think in many ways it's because we recognize ourselves in them in a kind of pure form. You know, they're the things that we want to keep at bay in our adult life. I think I still have a propensity to fall in love in a really intense and embarrassing way. But I maybe just don't let myself do it in the way that I did as a teenager.
Was there kind of a moment, though? Was there a climactic movie-like moment where you have a
conversation
with
your friend? Oh, there was loads of them. I remember once, when we were like 16, 17, we went to Lanzarote at the end of school on like a end of school holiday. There was a big group of us and I ran away. I ran and I stood on the beach on my own because I was having this big dramatic moment. My friend did it. He came to find me. I was a complete nightmare.
Gosh.
Yeah.
But it was brave to kind of confront it.
In some ways. But I think, when you're that head over heels in love, your reasoning kind of goes out of the window. You become pure instinct and emotion, which is the embarrassing thing, you know.
Well, the book is out in America already.
Yep.
From any listeners over there. And you have a book signing tomorrow. So you're launching this week. Is it on
sale
tomorrow?
I'm launching this week. So Dubray on Grafton Street tomorrow, 6:30, if anyone wants to come. And then it's officially out on Thursday this week. Yeah.
Open heaven. And best of luck, by the way, on the Dylan Thomas Literary Prize. You're in the finalists there. The only poet.
Yeah, the only poet.
But it's not for this novel. It's for your...
It's for my last collection of poems, which was called Rapture's Road. And the event... For that, the kind of judging event is in the middle of May. So I'll
Swansea
find out then.
University, Dylan Thomas. I mean, it's Dylan Thomas. They need to give it to a poet.
They should do.
We're up against another Irish author, Ferdy Lennon.
He's brilliant.
That Laurie's Exploits. Yeah. I really love that one as well. So poetry's having its moment.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, it's Open Heaven, which is the novel, is having its moment. First of all, Sean Hewitt, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with everything.